Test 1, 2, 3, test 1, 2, 3, 8, 9, 6, 3, 5, 8, 9, 8, 8, 6, 7, 5, 3, 0, 9. What's the song?
8, 6, 7, 5, 3, 0, 9, 8, 6, 7.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Okay.
I got it. I got it. I think it's something like that.
Yeah, well, I said that number first, so I probably primed you. So anyway.
8, 6. No, but no, it's the right. It, that is the. I'll pull it up real quick. But I remember it, there. 8, 8, 6, 7, 5, 3, 0. There it is in lyrics. There it is. 8, 6, 7, 5, 3, 0, 9. There it is.
Okay, right there. So we got it right.
Oh, here we go. There.
That's Jenny.
Yes. 8, 6, 7, 5, 3, 0, 9.
Okay.
I got it. I got it. Jenny, who can I turn to? Oh my God, Jesus, I can't sing. Anyway.
Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Friday, May 3rd, 2019. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Bo is here again. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello,
and,
hello.
And
aloha.
Yes. And welcome to yet another episode of Curmudgeon's Corner. And yes, we are going to be lazy again, which means we have lightning rounds, which means we have not taken the time to plan or like come up with like major themes that we wanted
to time.
There was stuff going on, whatever. But basically we're lazy. So we've got
subjects. We've got things,
you know, as part of the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack over the course of the week, we've jotted down all kinds of things we might want to talk about. And so what we're going to do, as those of you who've listened a while know by now, is we are going to have, we are going to alternate Yvonne and I picking topics, either from this list or just random things we remember while we're talking. And we're going to do rounds of four, two from me, two from Yvonne. And at the end of each round, we'll basically decide, are we done or do we really feel like going for another round of four?
Right.
So that's the plan. And so, Yvonne, as is traditional most of the time, why don't you start out?
So you saw Dr. Zhivago? I mean,
I did.
I was telling Sam, I saw the list. I saw it like once. Okay. But it was like 40 years ago. The only reason I really saw it.
And wait, I my response, and Yvonne is saying something he said right before we started recording. 40 years ago, you saw it when you were like 9 years old. This is not like a movie intended for 9 year olds.
Not particularly. No. The thing is that, look, when, The one thing that I must say, that I probably saw a lot of movies that were not really appropriate for like 9 year olds at the time, because we got this VCR. We had a VCR. I mean, we got it like in the late 70s. Okay. It was beta. And so look, the thing is that how many tapes do you think were really available? Okay. For you to group what kind of movies?
Okay.
So, I mean, some of them were like, for example, I watched this movie. I don't know if you ever saw this movie called Fantastic Voyage.
Where they take this, I think so.
You must have, because they shrunk it with a ray,
yeah,
and then they put it inside a guy's body to go and like,
I know about it, but you know, I don't think I've actually
the guy
seen it.
Because the guy was super critical to some very important thing or whatever. And so, you know, so that was one. There was a James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me. Okay. That's definitely not 7, 8 year old appropriate. But back then, also, nobody gave a damn about these things anyway. And Dr. Zhivago.
Okay. So,
and so I watched it. I'm sure I remember it's Russia. It's cold. It's miserable. I remember the movie is not, you know, exactly a happy story that I could recall.
No,
not at all.
Most of these things. These Russian novels, and this was based on a Russian novel, which I have not read. Happiness is not a regular theme.
I noticed this when I went to Moscow. I mean, Russia is not really known, Moscow, for its like chipper and cheery disposition. I mean, you know, that's not exactly the vibe that you get really anywhere around there.
Right. So, yeah, so that's all your memories of the movie. That's it.
Basically, right? Yes, that's it. I saw it 40 years ago. What do you want from me? That's about it. It's all I can get from me.
Okay, I'll give you my summary of Dr. Zhivago, which I did watch. I mentioned a couple weeks ago, this is the 3-hour movie that I was watching in 15-minute chunks. Okay, so this is my method. First of all, I very quickly in the movie determined this was the kind of movie I had to actually pay attention to. I couldn't just have it on in the background while I did other stuff.
Yeah, that's correct. You really need to pay attention to this damn movie.
Yeah, yes. So this was one that I, you know, I would two or three times a week. It wasn't like every day, two or three times a week, I would sit down at my computer before I did other stuff. I would bring it up. I was watching it on Netflix. I would watch 15 minutes worth of the movie. Then I'd hit pause and I would continue later. Right. And you know, being me, of course, like normal people, even if they were going to watch in chunks like I did, would like stop at the end of a scene or something like that, or at sort of a natural pause in the story. Rude.
No, you just stop 15 minutes. I mean, somebody's like about to get shot. The bullet could be halfway there. You're like, oh, I paused it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how I operate. So anyway, just the background, Dr. Zhivago was a novel by Boris Pasternak published in 1957.
Is that all?
That's all. 1957. And it was,
had to be, because part of the whole thing had to do with, they have to do something with a damn gulag and something, whatever.
It's set between the Russian Revolution started. It basically goes from 1905 to World War II, the novel. The book seemed like it didn't make it quite towards that whole time span. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. It says it's set from 1917 to 1922. So apparently the book spans a larger time span and the movie like is a part of it. But it's basically, bottom line, it's centered on the World War I, the Russian Revolution, and the Russian Civil War that immediately followed the revolution. Okay.
And as far as I remember, that was not a really cheerful period.
No. It was not.
There's nothing. I mean, you know, no.
Now, of course, this is one of those things where, of course, it's written from the perspective of someone who was not a fan of like the Russian Revolution and everything that was happening here. So there's a lot in here that when you, the movie came out in 1965. So we're talking height of the Cold War, right? So this is, you know, let's just put it. It is not a sunny portrait of like Lenin and the Bolsheviks and all this kind of stuff. You come away with a negative impression. Now, I'm not saying that negative impression is not well-deserved. I'm just saying...
What the hell?
It was not a happy time. It was not a happy time.
No, like, objectively, you couldn't say it was that miserable. Anything
you know,
other than misery.
Both World War I and World War II, the Russians
in Russia.
Yeah, it was lots and lots of people died.
Millions. I mean, literally, we're talking, not exaggerating here, millions of people died.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the Russian casualties in World War II were about 40 million casualties.
Yeah, it was crazy. Anyway, and here we're talking World War I, but in any case, the bottom line, it follows this person, Dr. Zhivago, through how he was impacted through this time period. I have not read the book, but the movie, I'll skip to my thing. First of all, it's a thumbs up. This was on my list because of AFI's top 100 movies, 100 years, 100 movies list, that they put out in 1998, which I've been working my way through. I started at 100. This was number 39. So I started in 1998 on this list of 100 movies. And so since I started at 100, I'm now at 39. What's that mean? 100 minus 39. That's how many I've watched now. So 60 some movies.
I put 61.
61 movies in, let's see, 98, 20 years.
That's not really a lot.
You know, but yeah, anyway, I like the movie. It was it kept my attention for those 15 minute slots. I'm not so sure, like, it probably would have been good watching it 3 hours straight through, but I just can't make that time amount of time commitment usually, right? You know,
but don't you do this thing where you guys like go downstairs to your living room with the big screen and you told me you turn out the lights and the thing and the whatever? What the hell do you guys watch?
Oh, almost always that's Alex watching cartoons.
So you don't actually do this?
Well, I used to way back in the day, like like when I first had a projector and the screen and all this kind of stuff, I would do that. I would go down there and I would turn out the lights and I'd watch a movie and blah, 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 you know, but these days, we used to, like, as a family, we used to watch certain TV shows together, and we would have like a once a week movie night, and we would alternate like which person in the family got to pick the movie. Right. So
I remember this. Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes, you know, it was a movie Brandy picked. Sometimes it was a movie I picked. Sometimes the kids picked a movie, whatever. And we haven't done that in years. Like, we never watch anything together anymore. Yeah, just because, like, we're all running around doing our own things. The only times we do watch something together, quote unquote, is when Alex is watching something and we're in the room, so we watch too, you know, pretty much, you know. And there are a couple of exceptions, but they're kind of rare these days. Like, most of the watching we all do independently, watching our own things. But anyway, back to, and that's kind of sad. We should start trying to do that together again. But it's, we're so fucking busy and we're all doing stuff. And, you know, it's a commitment to, like, okay, we're going to sit down here for 2 hours and watch a movie now. But it's probably worth it. We should do it again. We've got this big ass popcorn thing that Brandy uses. Like, she takes it,
she
organizes all kinds of events. And so she's got like one of these, you know, big, huge popcorn maker things on a rolling stand. They make them bigger, by the way. This isn't the size of the kind, like, you know, you see somebody at the park selling stuff out of. But it's like, you know, it's a fairly decent size. Like, you can make enough popcorn to, like, feed, like, 30 people or something, right? And because she uses it and she takes it around to events. But it's normally just sitting in our living room. So you know, we could make the popcorn and sit, and we should do that more often.
I don't know if, like, Dr. Zhivago is a movie that I associate with, like, eating, like, popcorn. I don't know why. It's just so depressing. I mean, really.
Well, and look, so back to my review. It is sort of sad because you have this, you know, you have all kinds of events that are basically sort of a series of tragedies that happen.
Basically.
You know, and nothing ever goes right and nothing's ever positive. And there are moments of optimism where you see, like, people are excited and, like, maybe this is going to turn out okay, but then it never does, you know? And so, yeah, that's kind of the theme, but it is engrossing. And, it's a good watch. It's not a fun, happy watch, but it's a good watch. And, so it deserves its place on this 100 best movies list, from 1998. And, you know, some of the things I've watched on that list, I haven't been really excited about. This one, yeah, this is a good movie. It's worth watching. Let's see. It won 5 Oscars at the time, best adapted screenplay, best original score, best cinematography, best art direction, best costume design. It was nominated for best picture and best director, but lost those to Sound of Music.
Well, that was a lot cheerier.
Yes, that, well, yeah, it also had Nazis, but yes.
Yeah, but it was a lot cheerier.
Well, this one didn't have Nazis. This was before the Nazis. But yeah.
This was before the Nazis.
But yeah, Sound of Music did have Nazis, so it's not entirely cheery. But
it's a lot cheerier.
And it has a happy ending, right?
Yes, exactly. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, whereas there is no happy ending in anything that is related to, like, Russian literature or anything related. So whatever.
But anyway, it's also got, like, you know, quite a list of people. You know, it had Omar Sharif was Dr. Zhivago himself.
Oh, that's right. It was Omar Sharif.
Omar Sharif. Huh. Yeah. And Alec Guinness, you know, who's Obi-Wan Kenobi, his brother was Dr. Zhivago's brother. Those are the other big names. Those are the two big ones that I recognize today. But it was interesting. Like, you get to a certain point and you're like, wait a second, that's a young Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, good movie. I liked it. It was fun. Fun's not the word.
It was worth seeing.
It's one of those movies that is a good movie. And you know, I like the music. It had like the zither music in the background, and I kind of like, you know, every once in a while I hear zither music, and I'm like, I kind of like zither music, you know. And all the cinematography and stuff like that, like, it was beautifully shot, and there was all kinds of scenery, and, you know, like you said, it's cold Russia stuff, and it's you know, some of it is like, okay, clearly they shot that on a stage, but some of it, you know, looks really cool. You know, it's just it's a good movie. It's worth seeing. It's not a fun, light, frothy, let's have a fun evening watch, but it's a good movie to watch. It's, you know, it's that kind of movie. So, okay, enough about Dr. Zhivago. And I put the book on my list to read at some point in the future, which probably means never, but it's on my list. It could come up.
Well, your book list is like mine, which basically right now, well, you know, yeah, exactly. It means like, yeah, well, you know, I'll die. The list will be there. You know,
yeah,
somebody will pick this up.
My great grandkids will read it.
Exactly.
Because of course, my kids will be obligated to finish my list, right? Like, whatever I haven't read by the time I die. That's how it works, right?
Yeah, I like that plan.
Yeah, they'll finish watching the TV shows I haven't watched and the movies I haven't watched too.
They'll go and, like, I asked Sam, said he has no more TV service, and he has this the DVRs are still sitting over there, and I'm like, what are the DVRs? Oh, we still got shows that we haven't finished watching, and I'm like, when's the last time you watched any of them? Oh, I don't know.
Couple of years.
So they're just sitting over there, just, you know, and, you know, whatever.
Exactly. Waiting. Okay. So that was topic number one. Now it is my turn. Something from a couple weeks ago that we did not talk about at the time. This one was weird because this last one was weird. So it was your choice of topic, but it was my movie. How does this work out? Should that have been my topic? No,
I guess it's who picks.
Okay. So I get to select. A few weeks ago, but we never talked about this whole thing about, hey, we're going to send all of the migrants that we don't know what to do with to the sanctuary cities.
Yeah, and the sanctuary city said, great. When can we, you know, can you let us know so we can, like, figure out how to get take them? So that died, like, rather fast.
Well, no. I saw something within the last couple days that indicated maybe they've actually started to do this a little bit. But there were questions as well about, like, is it even legal? But apparently nobody cares about that kind of stuff anymore.
Come on, in this administration, does anybody give a shit about that? I mean, give me a break.
And also, of course, their practicalities, like, you know, like the what's happening here is the people they were talking about doing this was people they picked up who are being released on bond or bail awaiting a hearing. But instead of letting them go wherever they were detained, they want to ship them to these places. But of course, those people were either already settled somewhere or were trying to get to relatives or whatever. So they had their place they were going. But let's say you do ship them to San Francisco, right?
Now,
if they've got relatives somewhere else, they're going to go there.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing that somebody pointed out was, like, they're trying to do this as some kind of punishment to somebody, right? Okay,
yes.
that's what they're arguing. But somebody said they were like, look, if you now announce that the moment you get to the border, you're going to get shipped to New York or San Francisco, okay? How is that a deterrent for them to come in illegally?
Well, but the punishment was not actually supposed to be for those people. The punishment was supposed to be for, let's show the fucking liberals, because once we send these people to their cities, they're going to be upset and they're going to show their hypocrisy.
What the hell do they think we have here? Where I live, 70% of us are not from here. What fucking difference do you think it makes? What? Oh, they're going to stick out like a sore thumb? What?
Now, the one thing I noticed at the time this came up is it seemed like to me the obvious answer was what you said and what a lot of the cities ended up saying, which was, okay, great. We'll welcome them. They're awesome. We're no problem whatsoever. We'll figure out, you know, how to welcome them, give them what they need, and move forward. But a lot of the initial reaction, and I'm talking in the first few hours, and then people sort of figured out the right response. The first few hours were more along the lines of, you know, the Trump administration is cynically doing blah, 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 and this is ridiculous, overreach, blah, whatever. It was a negative, like, look what evil thing the administration is doing now, using these people as pawns. And
it is true, but
that sort of opened itself up to exactly what the Trumpies were trying to get out of this was, look at the liberals, they don't want these people either, and we've now exposed their hypocrisy. Whereas the response that the cities got to within a day, to be fair, was the one that said that sort of called the bluff. But that first initial reaction by a bunch of people, I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? No, that's the wrong response. You're right. Look, he is being a cynical asshole, and this is using people as pawns, and you know, the people are going to end up where they wanted to go anyway, right? Because the U.S. doesn't have like internal passport controls. If you ship them to San Francisco and they wanted to be in Denver, they just, you know, get on a bus the next day, right?
Go to Denver. Exactly.
I think the response got to the right place, and I think it did neuter it really quickly, because once all the cities were like, sure, sounds great.
Send them.
Then they're like,
oh, I guess we weren't really punishing them. Of like,
well, but the thing people pointed out at the time, which I think is important here, is the mindset really was, oh my, they're not going to like this. They're going to hate the fact that we're sending these people here, because so many of these people believe their own bullshit. You know, they really believe.
No. But it's not. It's not that. It's, remember, they hate those migrants.
Yeah.
So they think that everybody else does.
Right.
Well, they're not understanding that, no, assholes, you're the ones that hate them. We don't.
Right. And also they it's not just that they hate them, it's also that they truly believe that these people would be a negative, horrible influence and would be increasing the crime rates, and you know, all of their own propaganda about why immigrants are bad, they really believe it. Despite, you know, we've said many times, you know, look, if you actually look at the statistics, the crime rates are less among immigrant populations, whether they're legal or illegal. And right. In communities that have a lot of immigrant population, again, legal or illegal, the crime rate actually tends to drop. And that these people, you know, especially if you then go out a generation, you end up with highly productive citizens, right? And in that first generation also tend to be very productive contributors to society. And by the time you get to the second or third generation, you know, it's a whole, you know, they're providing huge, immense amounts of value. And You know, but the people who are against this just don't fundamentally don't believe that at all. They believe this is an evil influence on society.
They don't understand that most of these people that are coming here, I mean, the vast majority, 90%+, are really leaving where they are because the crime is bad there. They're not coming over here to do more crime. Right. They have been, in most cases,
this is not the criminals leaving.
They are victims of serious crime, and they don't want to stay there. Look, even like though I'm from Puerto Rico, I'm like, you know, I don't need a passport to move. I mean, Puerto Rico's part of U.S., but the reason I don't live in Puerto Rico is because of the fucking crime. Okay,
right.
I mean, I got freaking robbed. I had three fucking cars stolen. While I lived in Puerto Rico, two within 60 days, I had a gun put to my head. I had multiple other cars attempted to be robbed. I mean, and this is, you know, unfortunately is a situation. So a lot of friends of mine that have moved over here from Venezuela, which is a subject maybe we'll touch on a little bit later. It's why they moved to the U.S.
Right.
I mean, they, you know, one of them had their car full of like a dozen bullet holes, you know, while they were driving to their sister's wedding, for God's sakes. Luckily, none of them hit them.
And the other thing that I will mention that I mention almost every time we talk about the immigration stuff, but it's worth repeating, is that the kind of people who have the level of initiative to pick up everything in their life and move halfway across the world to a completely unfamiliar, unknown situation in order to try to make their lives better and the lives of their family better is exactly the kind of initiative you want. That's the kind of people who are going to kick fucking ass because they are motivated to do so. Because they get here and they're motivated to fit in and figure out how to make money and figure out how to move forward. Yeah, and this propaganda about, oh, they just want to come here and get welfare. Or whatever, or live off the public tax is bullshit. Let's explain something.
The only ones that are eligible, people that come in and that are eligible for any kind of like a short-term welfare benefits are asylum, people that get asylum. Illegal immigrants cannot get welfare. Most legal migrants can't get welfare either. Only if you are, but you have to get the asylum approved.
Right.
Okay.
Well, but that's a lot of the current debate is, of course, about asylum seekers and how the Trump administration wants to basically not let people in on asylum claims.
No, I get that. But the thing is that, look, the number of people that are granted asylum is not, it's not that big. Okay. As a matter of fact, I remember I thought that the majority of asylum applications were denied in one way or another. So what I'm saying
I don't know those stats.
And the reason I don't have them, I'm sorry if I'm wrong about these, but that's the stuff that I recall off the top of my head. But look, even if my stats are wrong on that, we can look through that. The one thing about what I'm saying about it's that none of the other illegal immigrants that we're talking about are eligible for those welfare benefits. The reason why you give the asylum seekers those benefits, it's to give them some kind of transition for them to be able to get a job, have a place, have some help, so they could then get a job and get on their feet while in the country, and not just like for them to come in and be a burden on society. Okay. And so that's part of the help that they get about being in asylum. But a lot of them get work relatively quickly because I've met asylum seekers. Okay. That have been granted asylum. I met some from Colombia that I know, and they, you know what, the amount of time that those people got jobs, and they were like, they weren't wanting to be on welfare. They were wanting to get a fucking job and make money. Okay. And not just sit around on welfare, living in a shitty place, by no means at all. So, you know, it's just such it's just such a travesty that they keep accusing these people of shit that it's just their cartoonish view of what these people are because of their prejudices and hate. That's all it is. And it's not grounded on any reality whatsoever.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, this whole thing about sending people to sanctuary cities kind of fizzled. They were so excited that they were going to own the libs again, and it just really didn't work out. Yep. So that was my topic. Yvonne, your turn again.
The Mueller letter to Barr.
And I guess we should tie this in with Barr's testimony and all that stuff. Barr's
testimony, yes, yes, yes. So, Barr goes to Congress. He is asked multiple ways a few weeks back if he had heard anything from the Mueller team, whether they objected to his view of the report. And he's like, I can't remember exact answer, but it was a very, like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, you know, answer. And so, lo and behold, we found out that, I mean, it was a complete lie. I mean, Mueller had sent him the goddamn letter. Like, I mean, and he had it before he went and testified.
So
and
now
he
one
with that bullshit statement.
One of the things, and I think, you know, we did when Barr first put out his note about having received the Mueller testimony and his summary of the principal conclusions or whatnot. One of the things we did afterwards,
investigation report, not testimony,
whatever. One of the things that we talked about that letter was doing a close reading of it. And being very careful about parsing the words and, you know, showing how much of what he said wasn't what it seemed like he said. And I think that very much bore itself out when we saw the actual report later, where if you look at it sentence by sentence and look at his exact words he used and read it very carefully, those individual sentences are true. However, they are put together in such a way that if you listen to them casually, you come away with a completely different impression. And I think even in this case that you just described, I've seen a number of people sort of break down his testimony from a couple weeks ago and say, well, you know, he actually, the question was about Mueller's team, but the letter was from Mueller. And they asked about whether or not he, My point is, I think Barr has proven himself to carefully use weasel words. So you have to pay attention to it, where he's trying to structure things to be technically correct, but still be incredibly misleading. And I think that you, in his testimony again this week, you saw him repeating that. But I think, you know, when you come to rules like perjury rules, I mean, we had this debate a while back, that sort of literalism is not necessarily a defense that would hold up if it push came to shove.
Look, I know that you're saying that, but that interpretation of like Mueller's team and he's talking about the team and not Mueller. I'm sorry. When I'm talking about, what did the Pittsburgh Steelers team do? We're talking about everybody, including the owner of the goddamn team. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about just.
No, I was giving some examples, but the point.
But I know, but those are the examples that they use and they're fucking bullshit.
Yeah, I think that the clear point, whether or not you can pin an individual sentence as a lie, is that it was clearly the best possible interpretation is that he was putting a spin on it. But like, I think really like it's clear intention to misinform, to mislead. And yes, that's a freaking lie, you know?
Yes.
You know, where, and look, forget about that one particular thing, right? You know, the bottom line, the important thing is this letter that came out, that has been revealed, basically has Mueller, saying, what the fuck? This letter came out like a couple days after the summary notice that Barr did. And basically Mueller lays out in very polite terms, you know, that
You wrote is like seriously misleading.
It does not properly convey, and I forget the exact words, but it was like the blah, 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 including the conclusions, the context, a few other things. But bottom line is it boils down to what the fuck is up with this bullshit. It does not reflect what I've done. Here's the goddamn summaries that my team and I produced. Why don't you release those? Or why didn't you release those? And he declined to do that a couple times, said, no, I'm releasing the whole thing in a couple weeks. Now, a few people have pointed out, the people defending Barr is like, what the fuck are all you people upset about? You have the whole report now, so why does this even matter?
I mean, because he lied. I mean, he went and he created this whole damn document where he went and he said that Trump is exonerated, creates this entire, gives this entire false impression of the report, and allows people to be able to march around for weeks doing that messaging before you release the actual report that actually doesn't say any of the fucking bullshit that you implied in your damn letter.
Right. And here's, this is an absolutely important pattern. And we've seen this before, but just as a general principle, and I'm not putting this only on the Trump folks, but also just media in general. One of the patterns you see is if there's a big explosive report and comes out and gets a lot of coverage, it goes viral. Everybody talks about it, blah, blah, blah. And then, oops, we made a mistake. It was actually wrong. And they put out a correction. The correction gets like 10% of the attention. And the vast majority of people, if you're even lucky enough to get 10%, and the vast majority of people, if you ask them about it a few months down the line, nobody remembers the correction. They remember that big initial report. And of course, by nobody, I of course mean, large numbers. The people who are really paying attention will know, of course, but most people don't. Most people aren't obsessing over this and listening to every new development that comes out. So what they'll hear, the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and certainly Fox, even MSNBC, who's like really liberal, the first 24 hours after this thing came out, we're very much, it looks like there's no collusion and it's inconclusive on obstruction. And so that's a huge victory for the president and, so whatever. And then it took, 24, 48 hours for people to start saying, hey, wait a second. And reading it carefully, like we talked about, and also just sort of getting, there were reports here and there saying, wait up, the real report is going to be different and blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, several weeks later, we get the full report and it's very, very different. And it would have hit differently if the report had come out in full right at the beginning. And so, to the people who say, why does this even matter? You have the full report now. It's because it allowed Barr to set the public debate, to set the impression that lots of people had about this, to prime the pump, as it were, on how this would be received, so that even when we did get the full report, everybody's now comparing it to what was said initially, as opposed to comparing it to something else. Now that also, by the way, is part of this sort of priming effect. People also talked about the fact that the people who were going gung-ho about, Donald Trump is a Russian agent also potentially did a disservice, because even the full Mueller report isn't quite there. And people are like, oh, what the hell? It's not that. So who cares? But there's a definite effect that was had by this. So these lies are important. The misleading initial summary is important and is not undone by the fact that the redacted thing is now out.
Look, the repeated, listen, repeated lying like this is effective. Okay. All right. It's been shown it's effective.
Yeah.
It's why, you know, anybody that has done any propaganda for any regime uses it all the time, because it is effective. You know, and let's be clear, there is a significant segment of the population that they've got two things. Either they totally believe, they believe anything that this administration will utter out of their mouths. Okay, which is, there is a diehard group like that. And then there's the other one that just votes for him because they want to own the libs. But that's whatever.
Well, and as the
but they keep that core, hardcore group, you know, believe. I mean, if he went and like stood up there and admitted that he's a criminal, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a big difference, but this guy just, you know, decides to just lie and lie and lie and lie and double down and triple down on the lying. And now he's got an extended staff of people who lie, including, you know, now an attorney general who apparently is just, you know, has no scruples of any kind whatsoever.
So just to be clear, when you were saying he lies and lies and lies again, you were talking about Trump, not Barr at that particular moment.
I'm talking about Trump. Okay. Yeah. And that, you know, but he has surrounded himself now with a very capable set of liars around him.
Yeah. And so the testimony Barr did, I think was notable in that on the one hand, the Republicans on the committee were all about, you know, this is over, let's get it behind us, blah, blah, blah. We don't even want to talk about this. Let's talk about how the investigation began and were they spying on Donald Trump and all this kind of stuff. The Democrats on, I think, hit some real punches in terms of getting him to admit he hadn't looked at the underlying evidence. Getting him to really stammer his way through a question about whether he'd talked to people in the White House about the 14 investigations that are still ongoing.
Right.
Like he started out flat out denying that and then walked it back within seconds to be like, well, what do you mean? There was a question about whether the White House had asked him to initiate any investigations, and he's sort of like, well, what do you mean by suggest? Like, nobody's told me to, but what do you mean by suggest?
Oh, yeah. My God. I mean, that entire sequence with him was just, I mean, appalling. I mean, I have been deposed and like asked questions, and I've sometimes been a little bit evasive, but that went way, way beyond. My God. I mean, he is just, it's so, I mean, the way that he was doing it is just disgusting. I mean, he is just not even trying to answer any question. I mean, he is just sitting there listening to it and trying to figure out some objection to how it's posed in order to cast some doubt on the question. That's all I'm doing. That's it. Right. I'm not really here to answer anything truthfully. I'm just here to try to figure out some way that I can say
nothing,
you know, say nothing and act like I'm saying something.
Right.
Or act like you're not being clear.
But again, I think he is being careful. Like that one case where he backed off and then started asking about, you know, the details of what the question meant and then started putting caveats in, that's all like perjury defense, right? Because he's a lawyer. He wants to make sure that he's allowing himself enough wiggle room that he's not out and out lying. And again, this is the pattern that we've seen from him consistently recently. I don't want to speak for all his history of all time, but what we've seen over the last couple months is repeatedly a pattern where he tries to, where he is giving an incredibly misleading impression while trying to be careful to not actually make specific statements that are individually untrue.
Right.
And now I'm not sure he's completely succeeded at that. I think there are a couple times he may have slipped up. But for the most part, that's his game. He's trying to say very constrained, narrow, carefully worded, true things that if you are not paying incredibly close attention to exactly what he did say and which words he used, you will come away with a much broader impression of what he said than what he actually said. He may have denied this very, very narrow, specific thing and said that did not happen, but you come away with the impression that he denied something very broad. And just with the Mueller summary statement itself, is selective quotes that sort of give a partial, what he said was true, but he eliminated all the caveats, or whatever, and I think this is a pattern, and I think, this ties to just in general, how do you interpret these things, and a lot of it is going to feed into what you want to believe, right? So, like, you and me are like, oh my God, look at what he's saying, be very careful about it, he's obviously trying to mislead, he's a fucking liar, right? But if you want to believe him, then you're like, look, he said nothing that was not true, it's fine. It's right. Good. And he's defending the president and that's his job, damn it, right? Of course, that's not his job.
That's not his job.
But a lot of people think it is.
Well, Trump certainly thought it was.
Trump certainly thought it was. And I keep remembering this one tweet, and I forget which Trumpy conservative said this, but on the day that Barr was sworn in, he was like, we finally have a fully operational attorney general. This whole Mueller shit will be over very shortly now. And just watch what we can do now. Because for the first time at that moment, Donald Trump had somebody in place that would actually do the shit he wanted. Like, I think that the guy in between, what's his name? That was, he might've wanted Whitaker. He might've wanted to, but he had no actual ability to carry it through. Cause he was a nobody, right? He was an idiot and a nobody.
He was an idiot and a nobody. It's a terrible combination.
And so nobody would pay attention to him. No one would do what he wanted and he couldn't do it. Now Barr, on the other hand, comes in with some experience, some gravitas. He's been attorney general before. He came in with some degree of respect from the people underneath him. And so he's able to steamroll all this. And a key part of all this is, his sort of application letter to be attorney general, that unsolicited memo he gave on why basically everything the special counsel was doing was inappropriate, is exactly what he's carrying through with. He made the argument that the president can't obstruct justice because he's the president, and he's in charge of justice. So therefore he can't obstruct himself. It's nonsensical. Right. And that's the whole argument, So I think the one other part of this Barr picture that we haven't talked about yet is that this was all a hearing in front of the Senate. He was due the very next day to speak in front of the House, or not speak, but answer questions in front of a House committee, except the House committee decided, and of course this is the Democrats on the House committee because they're in charge on that side, that in addition to the House members asking questions, there would also be a session with House staff, professional lawyers asking questions. And the advantage of this, by the way, is if you've watched these congressional testimony things, each of the people has 5 minutes to ask questions. They're not very good at coordinating with each other. So if person A asks a question, then first of all, somebody from the other party gets the next 5 minutes. And then when the next person comes in, it's not necessarily following up from where the first person left off. It could be on some completely other tangent. And some of them are very good at questioning, like in the Senate, like Kamala Harris was on fire, in terms of the questions she was asking, being on target and pointed and very carefully designed questions that were hard to weasel out of. But lots of members aren't that good at those kinds of things. And so you end up with sort of a muddled mess, whereas having sort of the professional staff doing the questioning gets a little bit more intense and a little bit more ability to properly follow up lines of questioning, etc. And Barr basically said, no, I'm not going to do that. Now, this was a voluntary testimony. This was not under subpoena. And so he said, no, I'm not going to show up. And then left the committee sort of trying to figure out what they want to do next. And he also, at the same time, by the way, that he had been subpoenaed to provide an unredacted version of the Mueller report, and he has not done that either. And last I saw, there, frustrating me no end, and there's conversation about this on the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack if you're interested. We don't have to get into it here. But basically, the committee has given him another few days to come around. And then, if not, they're threatening to actually vote contempt of Congress. Yeah, and then they have to figure out what they would actually do about that besides just vote on it. But I don't know. It's fundamentally what we're seeing here now is a pattern where the entire Trump administration is under orders not to cooperate with anything, and they're daring Congress to be like, what the fuck are you going to do about it?
Right. Yep. So, and Sam is like basically jumping up and down and like saying, put him in the brig!
Yeah. I think there are a couple steps before that, but and we talked about this last week. I'm incredibly frustrated about how slow Congress is moving and how many times they give people the benefit of the doubt and, oh, you missed the deadline. How about another week? Do it next week. We really mean it. Instead of just jumping to the next step and being aggressive. I figure they'll get there eventually. I'm just frustrated by the speed.
Oh yeah, totally.
So we agree, you know, Barr's a slime ball.
Oh yeah. Fucking first class.
It looks like Mueller himself will be testifying in a few weeks. The exact date to be determined. I saw a report earlier today, a few hours before we were recording, that initially the House had been negotiating with the Justice Department to try to get Mueller's testimony, and that had really been going nowhere. And so now they're talking directly to the special counsel's office, and we'll see where that goes. I've seen people speculate on what Mueller will say. And basically saying, hey, this Mueller is a consummate professional. He's probably not going to say much that's not in the report himself. He's probably not going to publicly slam Barr, et cetera. I guess we'll see. It'll still be interesting to see it from him himself. One aspect of that I'm very anxious to see is he still a DOJ employee at the time he testifies? As of today, he is still a federal employee. Though the report wrapped up, he's still going to the special counsel's office every day. He still has a staff there. They're doing some sort of wrap-up activities now, although I, for the life of me, don't know exactly what wrap-up activities he's doing. And I wish somebody would report on that or get some information on, like, exactly what is he still doing? Because at first there was like, okay, his team is helping with the redactions and all that kind of stuff. But that's all done now. So what's he doing? Because if he is
fishing, I think.
Yeah. Well, but the thing is, if he is still on staff at the time he testifies, he's under some further ethical restrictions on what he can do and what he can say, because at least theoretically, he's still representing the DOJ as in being there. And so I think it would actually be more interesting testimony if Mueller officially legally leaves the DOJ before he testifies, because he'd be slightly freer in what he could do. Now, he might do the same thing in both cases. Who knows? He might feel the ethical obligation to still continue to act, but you know, in the same way. But I'd be interested, because this letter certainly seems to indicate that there is some level of tension between Mueller and Barr about how his report was handled after he turned it in.
Yeah.
And there's certainly some disagreements, it appears, just from reading the actual report summaries. And by the way, I'm still working my way through the report. I'm up to like page 95 or something right now, which is not a lot of progress since 2 weeks ago. Sorry, I kind of slowed down. after the first week. But anyway, just by reading the stuff in there and reading his summary sections, you can tell that what Barr's been saying about it just does not mesh with what Mueller was saying at all. Like it's like Barr is willfully misreading it, and that's a charitable interpretation. And so I think it'll be incredibly interesting to get Mueller's side of this thing. But it's still not going to answer all the questions people want to have answered. Like Mueller's not going to come right out and say, look, I wish I could have charged him, but I couldn't. He's not going to come out and say, look, we didn't have enough evidence for beyond a reasonable doubt to charge on X, Y, and Z, but it was more than a preponderance of the evidence. We did have lots of evidence here, just not quite enough. I don't think he's going to be that explicit.
Well, I mean, I think that it's something that are you really surprised? I mean, with how does this just transpired
No.
with all of this stuff?
No.
I think we expected it. I mean, I think we expected it the moment that we saw the letter. I think that you and I were a lot more skeptical about the content of the letter and said, you know, and all the things surrounding this guy. So, you know, it's been, you know, it's part for the course right now. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Next up, it's my turn again.
We should have that little dice thing. I just provided the effects.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to ask one. You mentioned it earlier. So I'm going to do another one of these things like you did with the damn movie at the beginning, where I'm going to suggest a topic, but I expect you're going to do most of the talking because you know a lot more about this than I do. Venezuela. It blew up again this week. There was a lot of shit happening. What's the update? What's going on?
Let me be clear about things. Shit has been happening like forever over there.
Yes.
It blew up like more like this week. Look, the thing is that it appeared that Maduro had reached a breaking point where he was going to get on an airplane and he was going to leave. It seemed like he was talked out. They're saying, and I don't know if this is true, that the Russians talked him out of leaving.
That is the report. And this report, by the way, I believe it came from Pompeo.
Yeah.
So it's coming from a Trump administration person. And
so I don't know.
Who knows?
Right. You know, look, here's the one thing about the situation in Venezuela. Look, it's been horrible. It is a humanitarian crisis. I mean, the number of people leaving on every angle from every border in any way from Venezuela is overwhelming, into Colombia, into Brazil, into Argentina. Look, I've seen people in exile in Venezuela. When I went to Ecuador, I've been in Argentina, Brazil, and in Colombia, and in Mexico as well. I encountered a whole bunch as well. And Miami. I mean, we got Venezuelans out the ass. Okay, all right, over here. look, I mean, I talked to a number of them. I mean, they, especially the ones that were here, they made a priority to try to evacuate as much as their family as possible from Venezuela. Why is that? There is no food. There is no medical care. The medical care crisis is so bad that the father-in-law of this person I had lunch with last year got sick. An ambulance came to pick him up. They went to three different hospitals. None of them could accept them to give him care. And the guy basically died on the ambulance. That's it. People are dying just of simple things, just any of the basics, for life. Food is an issue. It is a serious issue to be able to get food. This person I know that I've known for years. I mean, he went to visit his family, but he actually, because of empathy to his family, he stayed there for 3 or 4 months. And it's his wife's family. And he told me the conditions are just deplorable. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. So like right now, look, that has been a cauldron of like, and the mass protests have happened repeatedly over and over. The one thing is that ever since Maduro and Chavez have been in power, they have systematically enabled their friendly elements. Chavez himself was a military guy. Most of the accusations have gone around them is that they have been heavily involved in drug trafficking. They're just raking in millions, if not even billions, over the years in doing that. And so, you've got what really is a failed state at this point, like Venezuela at this point. It really, truly is. I mean, there are no, any of the standard things that you think in terms of like social safety net, in terms of being able to get food, health care, any of that is like, I mean, it's broken down like almost completely. And the group of people that are in power, you know, they're holding on because this is their enterprise for them to make money. I mean, they all the resources that were there have been just used up. The oil company, they bankrupted it, and now they can barely export any oil. They've done the same with every enterprise that they took over. They just plundered them completely and left them as useless hulks. Okay, and they've run out of shit to plunder. Okay, now it's damn drug trafficking and all this other illegal activity they're doing. So the one thing is that there had been a coup attempt 15 years ago, and the U.S. had backed it, and a lot of people were like, but it dissolved very quickly, and Chavez wound up being back into power. Like right now, the level of protest and just deep dissatisfaction in the country, okay? So now the U.S. and Russia have been trying to influence these groups in one way or another, but the thing is that I don't think they trust anything that the U.S. or Russia is saying. Okay, in any way, shape, or form, in terms of of support to them to stay in power.
So this is a big question. Because honestly, in this kind of situation, given what the Trump administration is, there's no way they're not trying everything they possibly can to meddle in this affair, right? And from everything I've heard, so is Russia, right?
So is Russia. So, but here's the thing about it, right? Those guys, I'm sure they're getting messages and offers and things said. But what is one thing you know right now? Is Trump going to invade Venezuela?
I really doubt it. I really hope not. I've heard that.
I will tell you that the answer is probably, and they think that it's a fucking no.
Right.
Okay. The last country that we did some kind of like a military invasion like this in the Americas was Haiti. And that was during the Clinton administration, okay? Mm-hmm. The Bush, Obama, have not, we have not done that again ever since then. That's the last place that we did.
In the Americas.
And Trump has not had an appetite for doing any of this. As a matter of fact, there was a tiff came this week. Apparently, Trump was encouraging Brazil to do so. But look, let me tell you something. If Brazil invaded Venezuela, oh my God, the protest in Brazil would be out of control. They would be like, they would not be for that. So even though they've got a right winger over there that kind of is sympathetic to Trump, he said, fuck no. And what I heard was that Trump was pissed off. Okay. That Brazil told him, are you kidding me? We're not fucking invading Venezuela. You're out of your mind. And so, so that left, that leveled that avenue. So whatever the decision is going to happen is, I think it's just based on the situation where they're in right now. When does it become untenable? And how would Maduro really make some kind of an exit into what country? Because they said they had a plane ready. So
well, the rumor about the plane said he was going to Cuba.
Right. I mean, because that's about the only fucking country that would take him. That's about the only option that he has, and he knows the shitty one at that.
So just a quick, make sure I'm on the same page with you in terms of the foreign interference, both from the U.S. and Russia. Your position on this is it's happening. Both the U.S. and Russia are trying their best to influence events there as much as they can. They're probably in there making promises. They may be bribing people. They may be doing all kinds of shit. But despite all of that, the fundamental events that are underway are primarily driven by local concerns anyway, simply because correct, there's so much going on. There's so much history here. There's so many factors that I believe one of the things you said on the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack was that it's like, there's this fire going on and you know, the U.S. throws a glass of water at it or something. And so, yeah, they're in there trying to do something, but it's not going to have a big effect.
Exactly. If Russia and the U.S. just basically had just not even attempted to meddle anything whatsoever, you would still have the situation going on right now. You know, what they're trying to do is influence the outcome. But the situation where it is right now, with the crisis, with the protests, would still be there. What they're trying to do is try to influence, you know, they're trying to nudge the outcome in some way that they think is favorable for them in one way or another.
You don't think, for instance, like that the whole fact that this alternate president who's
Guaido,
the fact that he decided to, you know, have this whole thing started and he declared himself president.
That would have happened, regardless.
This is not something where.
No, that would have happened regardless.
Because there are a lot of people saying that basically, look, you know, he's being propped up or given assurances or something. And that's why this is all happening. And the U.S. is behind the whole thing.
No, that would have happened regardless, because they were my understanding was he was the head of the Constituent Assembly, which was won a majority by in the election by parties that were against Maduro. But he outlawed it. And so that's why he called this, because he's saying that this act was unconstitutional. You took an unconstitutional act to dissolve the assembly, to install what you thought should be, your crony assembly, even though after a duly election. And that's why that happened. I think it probably something like that would have happened regardless because of the act that Maduro did at dissolving the assembly. So that was my take on that. At this point, there was another leader that had tried to do something like this years ago, but he got thrown in jail. And there was another guy that tried to do something like this, and he got murdered by the Venezuelan military.
So what's next?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I thought this week it was done. So I don't know what the hell's gonna happen right now.
And I saw some reports, and again, I don't know who to trust or whether what's right and what's wrong, that he's now being guarded by Cubans or Russians instead of by Venezuelans because he's not sure who in his own military he can trust anymore.
Look, for years, Cuba has had a significant presence in Venezuela in terms of doctors, military aid, and other things. So it would not surprise me that he is getting that kind of assistance. I wouldn't be surprised. No, not in the slightest.
Now, would you be surprised if the U.S. is doing similar things for the other side?
Yes, because this administration has shown no appetite to do anything like that at all. That's the reason.
So you think probably if the U.S. is involved here, they're doing things like, yeah, go, do this, but not actually providing any real substantive help. They're just sort of making statements. Correct. Like there was that tweet from Bolton or whatever, saying, this is your last chance, Maduro. You do get out or else. But you think it's all words, not like real stuff.
I think so. That's what it seems at this point. And I, from what I've seen so far, I mean, the only reason why the Russians and the Cubans have been there is because it's been directly at the invitation of the government. I mean, the Russians actually put some bombers in Venezuela for a little bit that then they sent back home because there's some protest or whatever. And so I don't know. So what happened with Russia right now and Maduro backing off? What happens next? I have no idea. Is he gone next week, or is he gone in a month, or is he holding 3 years? I don't know.
So just to clarify one further thing before we wrap this up, you know, with all the statements you've made, you know, you're no fan of Maduro, and you don't believe the U.S. is interfering or doing anything or helping the opposition to Maduro.
No, like I said, I think they're.
You think they are doing stuff, just
trying to influence it's, but it's just more words than anything actually substantive. Okay. Is what I'm saying.
So let me ask the follow-up question. Like, do you wish they were, do you think that the U.S. should be very heavily involved trying to help the opposition more so than you think they actually are?
Man, I don't know. That's a tough question. You know, I was asking somebody recently who's Panamanian about the invasion that took out Noriega, right?
Right.
And where the country is right now. what it seems in their opinion is that if it wasn't for that, they would be somewhere like Venezuela right now.
So what you're saying is they think that all things being equal, the U.S. invasion of Panama was a net positive. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Now, I'm not sure that would have been a popular point of view earlier.
No, it wasn't.
I don't know what people would think, whether what your friend is that a typical position among Panamanians? I have no idea.
That's what it seemed like, yes.
Okay.
I mean, now, you know, that without, I mean, if Noriega had been allowed to stay, the situation really in terms of Panama at the time was bad. I mean, people really felt, I mean, they told me that it was just really scary to live in Noriega, Panama. Okay. It really was. And that it did change substantially after that. And that, you know, I think a lot of people speculated that's what would have happened. Now
what keeps reminding me about this, though, is like, maybe what you're saying is true, maybe not. It's hard to test these counterfactuals. But at the same time, we have the counterexample of Iraq, right? Where, like, Saddam Hussein was awful, horrible, whatever. I think there's fairly convincing case here that we made it so much worse.
I know, but that's part of the reason why you don't hear me advocating for invasion of any type. That's, I mean, because, you know, in the majority of the times that we have done that, in the end, it hasn't really helped jack shit.
Yeah, I mean, my general impression that I've stated here over and over again, and not even just military invasions, but meddling in general, because we've done lots of things where we've supported opposition right. parties, or we've, you know, as we've said, in terms of the Russian meddling in the U.S. election, we've meddled in plenty of elections, okay?
Yeah.
It is a routine thing that was done for decades and decades and probably still today. You know, I'd say most of the time, whatever our intentions are, and I don't think they've always been like pure and good intentions, but even when they have been, the end result has not been good for the people on the ground. Like, you know,
in the overwhelming majority of the cases that has been the case.
I mean, yeah, we talked about Iraq. I think there's a similar case to be made for the Obama administration in interference in Libya that ended up overthrowing Gaddafi and have him killed in the street, and then all kinds of bad things happened in Libya after it. You know, Benghazi, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, I think there's case after case after case that you can say, oh, well, even if we had good intentions here, we came in and we made a fucking mess out of it, you know?
That's usually our MO. Yeah.
And you can point to counterexamples too. I mean, you can make arguments that, you know, we did improve things in the Balkans, for instance. Yeah, we came in and helped end that. There are other places that we've intervened that maybe you can make an argument that in the end it was better. You know, but I think on the whole, our record has not been good.
Our record has sucked. Well, let's be clear about that, which is why I'm not exactly like all too keen on doing of any action that we could take at this point. I would hope that Maduro saw that, look, his situation is untenable because it is. It's unsustainable. Okay. At some point, it's got to end. I just don't know when, but at some point, it's got to end. And the question is, how does it end? And how, when that happens, is that we can help them get back on their feet.
Right.
That's really the bottom line. So,
okay. That's the fourth topic of this segment. And I'm actually going to suggest that we end the show here rather than trying to do another segment of four because we started a bit late. It's really late for Yvonne. And also, I don't know how well I will succeed or not in hiding this in the final version of the show. But for about the last 20 minutes of the show, we've had a really crappy connection. And, you know, it's been hard to hear what Yvonne's been saying this whole time. And I'll try to hide it in the edit. But I think it's probably best. And we've even despite all that, we've been going almost an hour and a half. So it's a decent length show, right?
Yeah, it seems like it. Okay.
So yeah, Skype has really been sucking the last couple weeks, by the way. I just want to say that, you know, So I don't know what's up with it. And, you know, we went a long time without having any kind of problems. And lately it's just been, it's Skype. I don't know. I don't know if it's Yvonne's connection, my connection, or actually Skype. I would love to just blame Skype because Skype sucks anyway.
Okay. All right. Okay, well then we're at that. Not that.
Unless Yvonne, you had something else that you really, really wanted to make sure we didn't.
No,
miss.
I think we covered. You know, we covered the bar. We covered. The main things. I know that Biden launched. Now we got to wait and see to get a little bit more data on that, so we could talk about where the candidates are. So.
Okay. So thanks everybody for joining us for another Curmudgeon's Corner. Then an actual relatively short show this time. Well, I say relatively short. We used to do shows under an hour on a regular basis. This is still over an hour, but it's not a 3-hour show. It's not a 2.5-hour show. So, you know, whatever. So anyway, thanks for joining us yet again. As usual, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E. Yvonne is at I am Bo, I-M-B-O-U. And we'd love to hear from you there. If you really like the show, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner. And you can get all kinds of things depending on how much per month you give us. At $2 a month or more, you can get access to our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, which I've mentioned several times on this show, where we have ongoing discussions throughout the week on what's going on in the world, and we share links, and we talk about things, and all kinds of fun stuff. And we'd love to see you there, too. If you just want to get us feedback directly, feedback@curmudgeons-corner.com. We'll get an email to Yvonne and I. And let's see what else. Oh, leave reviews on iTunes, subscribe in iTunes, subscribe in whatever your player is. I think that's about it. Did I miss anything, Yvonne?
Nope. I think we got everything.
Okay. We'll talk to you all next week. Have a great time. Be safe. Take care of yourselves, and tune in again next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.